3. He rushed off to overtake Lizaveta Nikolaevna. She had not got far away, only a few steps from the house. She had been detained by Alexei Yegorych, who was following a step behind her in a tailcoat and without a hat. His head was bowed respectfully. He was persistently entreating her to wait for a carriage. The old man was alarmed and almost in tears. "Go along. Your master is asking for tea, and there's no one to give it to him," said Pyotr Stepanovitch, pushing him away. He took Liza's arm. She did not pull her arm away, but she seemed hardly to know what she was doing. She was still dazed. "To begin with, you are going the wrong way," babbled Pyotr Stepanovitch. "We ought to go this way and not by the garden. And secondly, walking is impossible in any case. It's over 2 miles, and you are not properly dressed. If you could wait a second, I came in a droshky. The horse is in the yard. I'll get it instantly, put you in, and get you home so that no one sees you." "How kind you are," said Liza graciously. "Oh, not at all. Any humane man in my position would do the same." Liza looked at him and was surprised. "Good heavens! Well, I thought it was that old man here still." "Listen, I am awfully glad that you take it like this, because it's all such a frightfully stupid convention, and since it's come to that, hadn't I better tell the old man to get the carriage at once? It's only a matter of 10 minutes, and we'll turn back and wait in the porch, eh?" "I want first... where are those murdered people?" "Oh, what next? That's what I was afraid of. No, we'd better leave those wretched creatures alone. It's no use your looking at them." "I know where they are. I know that house." "Well, what if you do know it? Come, it's raining, and there's a fog. A nice job this sacred duty I've taken upon myself. Listen, Lizaveta Nikolaevna, it's one of two alternatives. Either you come with me in the droshky, in that case wait here and don't take another step, for if we go another 20 steps we must be seen by Mavriky Nikolaevich."
"Mavriky Nikolaevich? Where? Where?"
"Well, if you want to go with him, I'll take you a little farther, if you like, and show you where he sits. But I don't care to go up to him just now. No, thank you."
"He is waiting for me. Good God!"
She suddenly stopped, and a flush of colour flooded her face. "Oh, come now, if he is an unconventional man. You know, Lizaveta Nikolaevna, it's none of my business. I am a complete outsider, and you know that yourself. But still, I wish you well, if your fairy boat has failed you, if it has turned out to be nothing more than a rotten old hulk, only fit to be chopped up."
"Ah, that's fine. That's lovely," cried Liza.
"Lovely, and yet your tears are falling. You must have spirit. You must be as good as a man in every way. In our age, when woman—" "Phew, hang it!" Pyotr Stepanovitch was on the point of spitting. "And the chief point is that there is nothing to regret. It may all turn out for the best. Mavriky Nikolaevich is a man. In fact, he is a man of feeling, though not talkative, but that's a good thing, too, as long as he has no conventional notions, of course."
"Lovely, lovely!" Liza laughed hysterically.
"Well, hang it all! Lizaveta Nikolaevna," said Pyotr Stepanovitch, suddenly piqued, "I am simply here on your account. It's nothing to me. I helped you yesterday when you wanted it yourself. Today, well, you can see Mavriky Nikolaevich from here. There he's sitting. He doesn't see us. I say, Lizaveta Nikolaevna, have you ever read Polenka Saxa?"
"What's that?"
"It's the name of a novel, Polenka Saxa. I read it when I was a student. In it, a very wealthy official of some sort, Saxa, arrested his wife at a summer villa for infidelity. But hang it, it's no consequence. You'll see. Mavriky Nikolaevich will make you an offer before you get home. He doesn't see us yet."
"Ah, don't let him see us," Liza cried suddenly, like a mad creature. "Come away, come away, to the woods, to the fields."
And she ran back.
"Lizaveta Nikolaevna, this is such cowardice," cried Pyotr Stepanovitch, running after her. "And why don't you want him to see you? On the contrary, you must look him straight in the face with pride. If it's some feeling about that, some maidenly, that's such a prejudice, so out of date. But where are you going? Where are you going?" "She is running. Better go back to Stavrogin's and take my droshky." "Where are you going? That's the way to the fields. There, she's fallen down."
He stopped. Liza was flying along like a bird, not conscious where she was going, and Pyotr Stepanovitch was already 50 paces behind her. She stumbled over a mound of earth and fell down. At the same moment,
there was the sound of a terrible shout from behind. It came from Mavriky Nikolaevich, who had seen her flight and her fall, and was running to her across the field. In a flash, Pyotr Stepanovich had retired into Stavrogin's gateway to make haste and get into his droshky. Mavriky Nikolaevich was already standing in terrible alarm by Liza, who had risen to her feet. He was bending over her and holding her hands in both of his. All the incredible surroundings of this meeting overwhelmed him, and tears were rolling down his cheeks. He saw the woman for whom he had such reverent devotion running madly across the fields at such an hour, in such weather, with nothing over her dress, the gay dress she wore the day before, now crumpled and muddy from her fall. He could not utter a word. He took off his greatcoat, and, with trembling hands, put it round her shoulders. Suddenly he uttered a cry, feeling that she had pressed her lips to his hand. "Liza," he cried, "I am no good for anything, but don't drive me away from you."
"Oh, no, let us make haste from here. Don't leave me."
And seizing his hand, she drew him after her.
"Mavriky Nikolaevich,"
she suddenly dropped her voice timidly.
"I kept a bold face there all the time, but now I am afraid of death. I shall die soon, very soon. But I am afraid. I am afraid to die," she whispered, pressing his hand tight. "Oh, if there were someone,"
he looked round in despair, "some passer-by. You will get your feet wet. You will lose your reason."
"It's all right. It's all right,"
she tried to reassure him.
"That's right. I am not so frightened with you. Hold my hand. Lead me. Where are we going now? Home? No. I want first to see the people who have been murdered. His wife has been murdered, they say, and he says he killed her himself, but that's not true, is it? I want to see for myself those three who've been killed on my account. It's because of them his love for me has grown cold since last night. I shall see and find out everything. Make haste. Make haste. I know the house. There's a fire there. Mavriky Nikolaevich, my dear one, don't forgive me in my shame. Why forgive me? Why are you crying? Give me a blow and kill me here in the field like a dog."
"No one is your judge now," Mavriky Nikolaevich pronounced firmly. "God forgive you. I, least of all, can be your judge." But it would be strange to describe their conversation. And meanwhile, they walked hand in hand quickly, hurrying as though they were crazy. They were going straight towards the fire. Mavriky Nikolaevich still had hopes of meeting a cart at least, but no one came that way. A mist of fine drizzling rain enveloped the whole country, swallowing up every ray of light, every gleam of colour, and transforming everything into one smoky, leaden, indistinguishable mass. It had long been daylight, yet it seemed as though it were still night, and suddenly, in this cold, foggy mist, there appeared coming towards them a strange and absurd figure. Picturing it now, I think I should not have believed my eyes if I had been in Lizaveta Nikolaevna's place, yet she uttered a cry of joy and recognized the approaching figure at once. It was Stepan Trofimovich. How he had gone off, how the insane, impracticable idea of his flight came to be carried out, of that later. I will only mention that he was in a fever that morning, yet even illness did not prevent his starting. He was walking resolutely on the damp ground. It was evident that he had planned the enterprise to the best of his ability. Alone with his inexperience and lack of practical sense, he wore travelling dress, that is, a great coat with a wide patent leather belt, fastened with a buckle and a pair of new high boots pulled over his trousers. Probably he had, for some time past, pictured a traveller as looking like this, and the belt and the high boots with the shining tops like a hussar's, in which he could hardly walk, had been ready some time before.
a broad-brimmed hat, a knitted scarf twisted close round his neck, a stick in his right hand, and an exceedingly small but extremely tightly packed bag in his left completed his get-up. He had, besides, in the same right hand, an open umbrella. These three objects, the umbrella, the stick, and the bag, had been very awkward to carry for the first mile, and had begun to be heavy by the second. "Can it really be you?" cried Lisa, looking at him with distressed wonder after her first rush of instinctive gladness.
"Lise!" cried Stepan Trofimovitch, rushing to her almost in delirium too. "Cher! Cher! Can you be out too in such a fog? You see the glow of fire. Vous êtes malheureuse, n'est-ce pas?" "I see, I see. Don't tell me, but don't question me either. Nous sommes tous malheureux, mais il faut les pardonner tous. Pardonnons, Lise, and let us be free forever. To be quit of the world and be completely free. Il faut pardonner, pardonner et pardonner."
"But why are you kneeling down?"
"Because, taking leave of the world, I want to take leave of all my past in your person."
He wept, and raised both her hands to his tear-stained eyes.
"I kneel to all that was beautiful in my life. I kiss and give thanks. Now I've torn myself in half, left behind a mad visionary who dreamed of soaring to the sky. 22 ans here, a shattered, frozen old man, a tutor chez ce marchand, s'il existe pourtant ce marchand. But how drenched you are, Lise," he cried, jumping onto his feet, feeling that his knees too were soaked by the wet earth. "And how is it possible? You are in such a dress, and on foot, and in these fields. You are crying. Vous êtes malheureuse. Bah! I did hear something. But where have you come from now?"
He asked hurried questions with an uneasy air, looking in extreme bewilderment at Mavriky Nikolaevich.
"Mais savez-vous l'heure qu'il est?"
"Stepan Trofimovitch, have you heard anything about the people who've been murdered? Is it true? Is it true?"
"These people. I saw the glow of their work all night. They were bound to end in this."
His eyes flashed again.
"I am fleeing away from madness, from a delirious dream. I am fleeing away to seek for Russia. Existe-t-elle la Russie? Bah! C'est vous, cher capitaine. I've never doubted that I should meet you somewhere on some high adventure. But take my umbrella, and why must you be on foot? For God's sake, do at least take my umbrella, for I shall hire a carriage somewhere in any case. I am on foot because Nastasia, would have shouted for the benefit of the whole street if she'd found out I was going away, so I slipped away as far as possible incognito. I don't know. In The Voice, they write of there being brigands everywhere, but I thought surely I shouldn't meet a brigand the moment I came out on the road. Cher Lise, I thought you said something of someone's being murdered. Oh, mon Dieu, you are ill!"
"Come along, come along!" cried Lisa, almost in hysterics, drawing Mavriky Nikolaevich after her again.
"Wait a minute, Stepan Trofimovitch!"
She came back suddenly to him.
"Stay, poor darling. Let me sign you with the cross. Perhaps it would be better to put you under control, but I'd rather make the sign of the cross over you. You too, pray for poor Lisa. Just a little. Don't bother too much about it.
Mavriky Nikolaevich, give that baby back his umbrella. You must give it him, that's right. Come, let us go. Let us go." They reached the fatal house at the very moment when the huge crowd which had gathered round it had already heard a good deal of Stavrogin, and of how much it was to his interest to murder his wife. Yet I repeat, the immense majority went on listening without moving or uttering a word. The only people who were excited were bawling drunkards and excitable individuals of the same sort as the gesticulatory cabinet maker. Everyone knew the latter as a man really of mild disposition, but he was liable on occasion to get excited and to fly off at a tangent if anything struck him in a certain way. I did not see Liza and Mavriky Nikolaevich arrive. Petrified with amazement, I first noticed Liza some distance away in the crowd, and I did not at once catch sight of Mavriky Nikolaevich. I fancy there was a moment when he fell two or three steps behind her, or was pressed back by the crush. Liza, forcing her way through the crowd, seeing and noticing nothing round her, like one in a delirium, like a patient escaped from a hospital, attracted attention only too quickly, of course. There arose a hubbub of loud talking, and at last sudden shouts. Someone bawled out, "It's Stavrogin's woman!" And on the other side, "It's not enough to murder them, she wants to look at them!" All at once, I saw an arm raised above her head from behind, and suddenly brought down upon it. Liza fell to the ground. We heard a fearful scream from Mavriky Nikolaevich as he dashed to her assistance and struck with all his strength the man who stood between him and Liza. But at that instant, the same cabinet maker seized him with both arms from behind. For some minutes, nothing could be distinguished in the scrimmage that followed. I believe Liza got up but was knocked down by another blow. Suddenly, the crowd parted, and a small space was left empty round Liza's prostrate figure, and Mavriky Nikolaevich, frantic with grief and covered with blood, was standing over her, screaming, weeping, and wringing his hands. I don't remember exactly what followed after. I only remember that they began to carry Liza away. I ran after her. She was still alive and perhaps still conscious. The cabinet maker and three other men in the crowd were seized. These three still deny having taken any part in the dastardly deed, stubbornly maintaining that they have been arrested by mistake. Perhaps it's the truth, though the evidence against the cabinet maker is clear. He is so irrational that he is still unable to explain what happened coherently. I, too, was a spectator, though at some distance, had to give evidence at the inquest. I declared that it had all happened entirely accidentally, through the action of men perhaps moved by ill-feeling, yet scarcely conscious of what they were doing. Drunk and irresponsible. I am of that opinion to this day.